You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. I'm Art Ray. Today's guest is PMH Atwater, LHD. PMH Atwater is one of the original researchers in the field of near-death studies, having begun her work in 1978 after having three such experiences of her own. In 2005, she was awarded the Outstanding Service Award from the International Association for Near-Death Studies and the Lifetime Achievement Award from the National Association of Transpersonal Hypnotherapists, as well as an honorary degree in therapeutic counseling from a school in Sri Lanka. She is the author of several books, including We Live Forever and Death Experiences, The Rest of the Story. She is a featured presenter at the upcoming Afterlife Awareness Conference in Virginia Beach, presented in cooperation with Edgar Cayce's ARE from Friday, March 9th to Sunday, March 11th, 2012. Her presentation will address what she has learned from her research with nearly 4,000 near-death experiencers regarding what it feels like to die and what death is. You can find out more about the Afterlife Awareness Conference by going to afterlifeconference.com. Thank you for coming on the show today.
Well, I'm just absolutely thrilled to be here. This is great fun.
Now, how did you become interested in near-death experiences?
Well, it's simple. I died.
Oh, good.
Really, I died. I died three times in 3 months in 1977. What started my battle and struggle with coming back to life, if you will, was a miscarriage followed by extreme hemorrhaging. That was death number one. That was January the 2nd, 1977. 2 days later, major thrombosis in the right thigh vein, which dislodged, followed by the worst case of phlebitis the specialist had ever even heard of. And then 3 months later, March 29, we still don't know for sure today what killed me. No vital signs. They think it was a heart attack, but they're not really, really sure. They were never able to, you know, document just exactly what killed me the third time. And most people seem to forget, Art, that near-death experiences, for the most part, come from violence or trauma or, you know, really heavy kind of issues. So when the experience is over, you've got a body to rebuild. So you're very much concerned with that, your family, your job, your body, your health. And superimposed, if you will, or sort of bleeding into that or part of that, is this, you know, this new perspective, this greater perspective, this greater passion, this puzzle, this mystery, you know, what on earth happened to me? You know, I wasn't here. I was elsewhere. And you had, you know, this, you seen the sights, you heard the messages, depending on, you know, what kind of experience you had. And you were out of your body, you know, and there was just a whole new world in your back in this world. And somehow this world seems like black and white compared with all that color. You know, and you're trying to focus again on this world and the colors in this world and the sounds and the people, and it just doesn't match. So you've got this real puzzle of, well, what am I going to do about this? And what is it? You know, and many, I mean, this is common with near-death experiences. They think they're going crazy.
Well, I used to be a chaplain assistant, and I was assigned to Walter Reed. And what some people might think is post-traumatic stress disorder might be somebody coming back from a near-death experience.
Right, right. And by the way, we find that a lot in the military. Veterans have a really tough time with near-death experiences because they don't dare talk about it. If they do, they're labeled psychotic, and they can't get insurance. So it's a real, or proper care. So it's a really big deal. Plus, you know, you come back a very different kind of person, and you're not the warrior you used to be. And it's really big issues for a veteran. And Colonel Diane Corcoran, former Navy nurse, is now fostering and part of a campaign to bring this kind of information, even this kind of therapy or these kinds of discussions, into military hospitals, because it's become such a huge, huge issue that these men and women go on afterward trying to fit the military model, and they don't. And over the years, it gets worse instead of better. So we're trying to do everything we can to bring this kind of information into the military and into the veterans groups.
Could you tell us more about your personal experiences? Were there commonalities between your three experiences?
Well, no, each was very different.
Wow.
And you find this with most people who have multiple experiences. And by the way, there are a lot of people who have multiple experiences. In my own research, the one who had the most that I found was 23. And this was a man who was not expected to live past maybe 3 or 4 months when he was born. And he had major, major issues and surgeries and traumas throughout his life. He was in his early 40s when I met him. He was wheelchair bound. And I asked him, why? Why so many near-death experiences? And he just kind of smiled at me, and he said, that's what kept me going. He said, in a way, it was kind of like a vitamin pill. You know, each time I would have another episode, and that gave me the courage and the strength to keep going, because I knew I had to keep going. This was my job. I had to be here, and this is what made it possible. All these near-death experiences made it possible.
What did you experience on your first near-death experience?
That was a really quick one. You know, in my own work, I was able to isolate that there are 4 major types of these experiences. There's what I call the initial, which is very short, usually. Well, it's always very short, like 1 or 2, maybe 3 elements max. Then the unpleasant or the hellish, then the pleasant or the heavenly, and then the transcendent. So of those 4, my first one was definitely the first one, initial. It was just a quick out-of-body experience, but it was very deep. It was very vivid. It was very impactful, and I really didn't recognize what was happening at all. And then the second one, 2 days later, was very complicated, very long, very complicated. Also had an out-of-body component, was able to, loved ones that had died and gone on, was able to meet them, see them, greet them again, including a grandfather I had never seen in my life, never even seen photographs of him. And he came up and introduced himself to me. Was able to see Jesus, had an episode with Jesus, the life review, an experience with creation, it just sort of went on and on and on. Third one was also long and complex, and it really focused. It also had an out-of-body component. All 3 of mine did. I just want to jump right in here and say that the number one element most people experience is out-of-body experiences. So I certainly had those. And then combined with my third one was an experience way, way deep, way out in the heavens, traveled way past Earth and entered a realm of, I really felt like I was at the center point of creation and consciousness and was there to witness creation as it actually occurred.
Hmm.
And there also had other elements, and it was also very long. But in that third one, there was a part of that where a voice spoke. No body, you know, kind of a disembodied voice, but it wasn't a voice like you and me talking. It wasn't a voice like a speaker at a platform with a microphone. It was a voice that it filled the universe. It was that big. It was so big. How do you explain, how do you even describe a voice that is so full and so thunderous and so big? You know, it's that kind of voice. And I called it the voice like none other.
We'll be right back with more with PMH Atwater. You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. Let's continue our conversation with PMH Atwater.
And I called it the voice like none other because I didn't never heard a voice like that before. And the voice said, and I quote, "Test revelation. You are to do the research. One book for each death." Then it showed me what that meant. It did not name book one, but it did name books two and three. It did not tell me or show me how long it would take to do the work or how I would do the work. And then I came back. I was literally sent back. So I'm very honest with people when they say, you know, talk about your research. Why are you a researcher? And just very blunt and say, I would have never chosen to be a researcher, a pioneer researcher in the field of near-death studies. You know, you'd have to be crazy to do this stuff.
Hmm.
You know, I would have never chosen that. And let's be very clear here. I did not choose that. I was sent back to do the job, and I was given the energy I would need to do the job. People say, where does all your energy come from? I said, from dying.
That's
where it came from.
Hmm.
And I, for 33 years, I have worked, about the first 15, 20 years of that, I was working pretty much a seven-day week. And I would work on the average of about maybe 12 hours a day. So I was insanely dedicated to do this work. And then I finally decided, you know, it's okay to do a 5.5-day week, maybe a 6-day week, and maybe work 8 hours a day. So I've been very kind to myself in the last few years. I've sort of ratcheted down the schedule a little bit. And, you know, the book I wrote, Near Death Experiences, the rest of the story, is the summation of all my work. That's 33 years, but it's also, you know, and your ARE people will be very interested in this. It also includes, especially as a cross comparison, the research I was doing before I died, for well over a decade before I died. And that was with easily 3,000 people, easily 3,000, probably more. That was back in Boise, Idaho. And what really kind of initiated that for me was in 1966, when I ran into a lot of problems with automatic writing. I didn't know what I was doing. And a friend showed me how to do this, and I thought, oh, that's very clever, interesting. So I tried it and found out that I could do it, and got into the dark side of it, you know, a not very good entity, mm-hmm. and freaked me out. And so unbeknownst to me, this friend then scheduled a meeting that I was to go to and made arrangements with my husband and children. You know, she'd spirit me off on a Sunday afternoon, a big ride and, you know, past Floating Feather Airport in Boise, Idaho, and in an area I'd never been before. And we pulled out to this little house, and she asked me to come in and came in. And here's this room full of people, Art. The governor's assistant, a number of school principals. I mean, mostly professional people. We're not talking about hippies. You know, these were not hippies. These were professional, solid people.
Wow.
And they had heard that I'd gotten in trouble with this, so they wanted to help me. They wanted to rescue me, to heal me, and they did the 44 breath Huna prayer. And I tell you, I literally felt lightning bolts enter both palms of my hands and go up my arms and throughout my body and out the top of my head. And I looked at these people. I mean, it was just, never had anything like that before in my life. Looked at these people and said, I don't know who you are. I don't know what you're doing. But whatever it is, may I join your group? Because I recognize that this is good. This is healing. This is uplifting. This is spiritual. And I wanted to be a part of that. And it was an ARE study group.
Oh.
It was study group 2 in Boise, Idaho, headed by Lloyd Cook. And, you know, and that was my introduction to the whole mystical, psychic, intuitive, mysterious worlds that most people say they can't see, but you really can if you want to. That was my whole introduction, was Edgar Cayce and the Search for God study book. And, you know, that's what they were studying, Search for God study book. And we all in this whole group got stuck on book one because we couldn't get past patience.
We
kept taking it over and over and over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we met weekly and we had assignments, you know. We had the assignment for the week, so everybody had to go out and do, work it. You know, it wasn't enough that you read or discussed. You had to go do. And then, you know, when you came back the next week, we'd go around and report. Everybody had to give a report, and then we discussed that. And then, if you didn't do so well, you had to admit that you didn't do so well, and we discussed why. And it was such a rich, meaty, active group, and that's how I started. And I was just one of these people that I had to find out things for myself. I was just born that way. You know, I did my first double-blind study with a control group at the age of 5. You know,
wow.
Yeah, I was one of these kids that, you know, I'm just so highly curious. And I was raised with people and at a time when you didn't ask questions. People who asked questions, that was considered shameful. That if there was something you wanted to know, you needed to go out and find out for yourself. You never, never, never ask a question. That was a sign of stupidity. So that wasn't allowed. So I had to, you know, you do it yourself. And so, you know, I did it myself. And so after all this stuff with the ARE, and I'm like this hungry, starved person, you know, I'm reading all the books, and I'm going to the state library, and I'm going to the other libraries, and I'm talking to people, and I'm interviewing people, and, you know, I just can't get enough knowledge. because I was learning about a whole new world I didn't know existed, and it applied to me, and I fit in this world, and this world was a part of me, and I wanted to know more about it. And so I started Inner Forum, Idaho's first nonprofit, metaphysical, spiritual corporation. And through Inner Forum, we started out having, two programs a month, and then we, you know, reduced that to one a month, where we would present these different topics, bring in speakers, and what I wanted to do was to educate the public about fraud versus reality. So I went around to all the major churches in Boise and explained what Inner Forum was and what our goal was, what our mission statement was, to make certain that they didn't jump to the conclusion that we were devil worshipers or, you know, crazy people or hippies or whatever, mm-hmm. that we were really solid folk, and we wanted to explore the truth behind. And by golly, all the churches were with me. And when, launched the program, the years the Inner Forum ran, we never had a problem with churches. And, you know, these different people in different parts of the state, country, and what have you, different places, that have these problems when they start up maybe a center or a study group or what have you, I would advise all of them to do what I did. You know, go confront, sit down and talk with your different religious groups, civic groups, local groups, and let them know who you are, what you're doing, what your mission statement is, and talk over one-on-one their concerns. And it makes such a difference. You know, it's like day and night. So I was highly involved in bringing in speakers and mediums and all kinds of stuff and studying them and becoming them and teaching it. And I was a Ghostbuster. I mean, you name it, I was doing it. Hmm. And doing it to the point of almost professional, and became a hypnotherapist specializing in past life regressions. And, I mean, taught sensitivity training and all this stuff. Yeah, extremely active until I died. So I took all that information, the previous, and combined it with the 33 years that after I died, when I'm doing near-death work, strictly near-death work, and all of that is contained in that book, Near-Death Experiences, the Rest of the Story.
We'll be right back with more with PMH Atwater on Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. We're back with PMH Atwater.
Near-death experience is the rest of the story. In other words, I go deeper in that book than anybody else has on the subject of near-death, and I confront issues that nobody else has. And I dare to say in the book what I have never dared to say before. So I really recommend it.
You'll be speaking at the upcoming Afterlife Awareness Conference from March 9th to the 11th, 2012.
Right.
What will you be talking about there?
Well, I'm very, very excited about that conference. I hope everybody memorizes the dates, you know, March 9th through 11th in Virginia Beach, Virginia. A raft of speakers that's just, you know, talk about wow. It's just incredible speakers. If you go just to hear Ken Prather, the man is awesome. Just I think most of the bones in his body were broken and beat up and surgery and near-death experiences and what have you. And and the man that has emerged, the Ken Prather today, and what he's been able to do with hospice and children and bring joy into people's lives, and you know, he's crippled and, you know, it's still so structurally limited in what he can do. Just to be around this guy is just, you know, it's like going to church. You know, and entering the mind of God. I mean, here's Ken Prather. So at this afterlife conference, a lot of people like Ken Prather, but I especially recommend Ken. He says, and I'm going to be there too, and I'm going to be more personal. You know, I've been this dedicated, heavy-duty researcher for so long. And be a little bit more personal and talk about what I call my little love book, which is We Live Forever, and the ARE published that. Thank you very much, ARE. And and my DVD, As You Die, and be a little bit more personal about me and the work I do and what I've learned.
Your book, We Live Forever, why did you write that?
Oh, you love stories, don't you? I think it was fall of the year, right about now. And I had gone to a conference, and coming home late at night, and the phone rang, and I answered the phone. It was my son. He lives in California. His name is Kelly. And Kelly was on the phone. He was crying. And he talked about his daughter, my granddaughter, our granddaughter, Miriam. And she was seizing one day, dead the next. She had just died. It was bacterial meningitis. And it had collapsed the brain onto the brainstem. There was no way she could be saved. So in 2 days, you know, a happy, wonderful child, 2 days later, dead. And, you know, and she was, she was 2 years old. And my job at that time really was to be there for my son and to just listen. And it just have that energy link and that love link and just listen to the man, which I did. And I put the phone cradle, put the phone down. And I turned to leave the room. And there physically manifested before me was my former mother-in-law. I've been married twice in this lifetime. First time was with the Huffman family back in Idaho, and Mom Huffman. I can never quite get along with her. We had issues. And the main issues were, she was a very, very loving, open, generous woman who just came in and took over. I'm not going to call her a control freak, but she just took over the organization, the dinner, the person's life. It doesn't matter. She came in and took over. She had that kind of powerful personality. And very much a family woman. I mean, her family meant more to her than anything else in the world. She was really the grand matriarch. She had four children. I had married her youngest and only son. And I'd had five fathers and two mothers and wound up kind of raising myself in many ways. And I didn't know what a family was. You know, and looking back, I kind of think maybe I married the man just for his family, because I didn't know what a family was, and I wanted to know. And he had a very big, large, loving family, and I just wanted to experience that. Well, but you know, Mom Huffman was a little too much. And so I backed away from her, and I did not want to be a part of her. I didn't want to converse much or anything. I mean, I was, you know, respectful and present and there and helpful, but I was not friendly. And the woman just rubbed me the wrong way. And when she died, there were a huge crowd, lots of people there, people flying in from states away because she had been so generous in the way she had helped people throughout her life. And her funeral was so big they had to hold it in the high school gym. This is how venerated this woman was. And I was ashamed of myself for not liking her. And so, you know, and just before she died, we were with her, and she went around the family and around the bedside, you know, and she looked straight at me, and she said, you know, I want to know, do you love me? And there was another family member next to me that popped up and said, well, of course we all love you. And I never said anything. And that kind of haunted me. So sure enough, when I hung up that phone, there was Mom Huffman. Now, and I want to back up here just very quickly and say that when Miriam was born, I was able to fly out to California soon after. And when I looked in her eyes, I saw Mom Huffman. Mom Huffman was Miriam. Miriam was her own grandmother, literally. Mom Huffman had incarnated into Miriam. I had no doubt. And interestingly enough, as she grew, as Miriam grew, she looked just like me. She acted just like me. It was spooky. You know, and I'd be around her, and there was May. And other people who knew May made the same comment. So it wasn't just me. I was absolutely convinced that Mom Huffman came back as her own granddaughter. And that would make a lot of sense because my son, Kelly, was her favorite grandchild. And he had red hair just like she had red hair. So that made him special. So it made sense to me that she would come back through his line. And so she came back as Miriam. So when Miriam died, then that released Mom Huffman. And Mom Huffman was there, standing there in my room, looking at me and smiling. We went through a session of forgiveness. I mean, it was very, very tearful. In fact, I was sobbing, you know, going back to the moment of her bedside and she's saying, do you love me? And I couldn't answer. So I was able to tell her that, yes, I really did love her. And so we had this session. And then after that was over, she looked at me very seriously and she said, will you write a book about death? And I just was stunned. And I mean, you know, I started talking to her and I said, you know, there's Stephen Levine, there's Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. I mean, all the great books about death have been written. You know, who am I? I'm a near-death researcher. I don't write about death itself, except, you know, what I get from near-death experiencers and my own experiences with death. Certainly, I do talk about death, but to write about death as she wanted me to, it's to go deeper on the subject and just dwell on that subject, death. You know, I did not feel qualified to do that. And so I just went on, you know, all of these reasons why I could not possibly write that book.
We'll be right back with more. You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. Let's continue our conversation with PMH Atwater.
And then And she just kept insisting. So I did what I always do when I have a big question. I go into my guidance. So I relaxed, went into that space of my own guidance where I feel aligned with the God of my being. And I ask there, would this be something that would be for my highest good and the highest good of all concern? Would this be appropriate for me to do? And all I heard was this laughter. And finally, the word saying yes. So I'm fully back in my body now, opened my eyes, and she didn't go anywhere. She was there and looked at Mom Huffman and said, yes, I will write a book about death. And she didn't say anymore. She just kind of nodded her head, and then she turned and floated out of the room and out through the top of the wall near the ceiling. She exited. I've never seen her since. Never had any contact with her since. And so the puzzle to me was, well, goodness sake, how do you write a book about death? So I took all my paper and pencil and, stuff, and we went to California, of course, for the funeral and wrote everything down and interviewed people and kind of did the reporter thing as well as being the grieving grandmother. And just wrote down, what I saw and felt and people who came for the visitation, what they saw and felt and all these different things, and wrote a book and got it right back again from the publisher saying, this is crap. Well, my emotions were in the way. I'm still a grieving grandmother. I could not write a book for anybody else. Obviously, it was just for me. So I had to back away. And I had to back away from the book for a number of months before I could come back objective and say, okay, what can this book be?
We're almost out of time.
Whoa, that sure went in a hurry.
Oh, yes. Well, could you tell us, is there a website where people can learn more?
Sure. My website is www.pmhatwater.com. No periods or anything, all lowercase, one word, pmhatwater.com. And yes, PMH is my name. It's my full, legal, complete name. It's not a nickname. And I would invite people to, look for the DVD As You Die. It's also out in CD form if you want. And that contains the summation of over 3,000 near-death experiencers saying what death is and what it feels like to die. And that DVD was arranged and made in such a manner that the last 15 minutes are designed to be played after the individual has died. We know scientifically that the last faculty lost in death is the ability to hear. So you want to always talk to a corpse. They can still hear you for a while. Science says maybe 15 minutes, but how do they know? I mean, I don't know how they figured that out. But anyway, a corpse can still hear. Mm. So certainly they can hear this before they die, but especially after they die. So that DVD is made so that as a person is dying, they can play this, the CD part or the DVD part, and it can talk them through death as their body dies. So it's very unique in that regard.
That's amazing. Thanks again for coming on the show today.
Well, it's been fun. Let's do it again sometime.
Oh, yes.
And many blessings to everybody.
It's time for the Thought for the Day. And today's Thought for the Day
will be read by Kimberly Rose. To find out more, go to KimmyRose.com. That's KimmyRose.com. Well, hello.
Hi.
And what's today's thought for the day?
Today's thought for the day is reading 849:25. Keep to those purposes, those attitudes of helpful hopefulness, that the opportunities accorded may be used in service to others. Such as an attitude kept in the mental forces will bring the renewing of the faith in the divine, which is the heritage of every soul. That's that. There's so much in there, because this is really, really, it's, to me, it's about community. I thought of the ARE camp, one of the family camp that I was blessed to be part of, and my children still talk about it. But this is like being of service and knowing that every opportunity that comes to you, even if it's just smiling at someone, it really, really can change the collective consciousness to peace, which truly is the heritage of every soul, because we are all part of the divine. And maybe one person that you go into the grocery store and one person just gives you this look, and they look sad and you smile at them. Maybe that one smile helps them to feel love, feel like they belong, and there's a renewing of the soul.
Oh, yes. It's amazing what you can do with one gesture or word that can really help somebody else.
You know, and that's all that matters, is just taking the time to do that, you know?
Oh,
to
yes.
To share that.
Wow. Well, thanks for doing the thought for the day today.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the show today. Thanks to PMH Atwater for talking to us. Make sure to look up her books, We Live Forever, and Death Experiences, The Rest of the Story. Also, you can find out more about the Afterlife Awareness Conference by going to afterlifeconference.com. Thanks also to Kimberly Rose for the thought for the day, and most of all to you, the listener. Thanks for listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce.